someplace there's got to be a place where people are free to discuss what they know and what they don't know and to find out what they can.
Radioactive Waves is presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Together, we will explore all things atomic, nuclear, and radioactive, along with some interesting surprises from our museum's collections and connections.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Anna Part, and I'm here today with my wonderful co-host,
David Gibson.
Hi, David.
How are you, Anna?
I'm doing okay. I am really excited for this episode. We're doing a Pride Month episode. I had a really good time researching this. It was really interesting. I learned some things that I did not know before, and I'm excited to share some stuff that I did know before, but I bet you didn't. So, not you specifically, David. I mean, all of y'all.
I'm sure there are always things that you find in your research that I did not know. So I'm sure there are things in this one that I didn't know.
Well, that's what we're here to do, is learn. So I'm excited that I got to delve into this a little bit. So, you know, we've done themed months in the past. We did Women's History Month and Black History Month, and we talked a little bit about why having a dedicated month is important, and it sets aside time to delve deeper into something that needs a little bit more time. So, as we've talked about before, the reason I brought this up as well is because there is very little information about the LGBT community, or what would become the LGBT community, at Los Alamos or Oak Ridge or any of the Manhattan Project sites. There is information that has been uncovered and brought to the forefront about Black scientists at Chicago, about women both in Los Alamos, Chicago, and Oak Ridge. There's records of all of these populations. They are very hard to find. They have been ignored. There's a whole lot of reasons that in the past 30 years, these gaps in the historical record have been slowly being filled. You know, historians have worked to fill in these holes in the historical records. The reason that these holes are there in the first place can be anything from historians just weren't looking at that, records weren't kept because nobody thought they were important enough to be kept. And then, of course, on top of that, the secrecy of the Manhattan Project created just a massive culture of secrecy and keeping records under wraps, or not even keeping the record, because the record was a liability or a security risk. And it, you know, the people who experienced the Manhattan Project were taught not to speak about it. So this is even more so the case for people who experience same-sex attraction during this period. As we know, it was very much a taboo at the time. In the 1940s and 50s, it became very unspoken about. And this is one of the problems that queer historiography, for all history, not just for the 1940s, not just for the Manhattan Project, is up against over and over again, is that it became taboo to speak about same-sex attraction in any way from a certain point. Usually historians will say the 19th century is when it really became, you know, the Victorians were not happy about it. So that's the reason queer historiography is tricky, because these are also real historical people who may not have wanted to ever be called homosexual or gay or lesbian or any of the myriad of terms that we now have, because one, they simply didn't exist, and two, they were often considered slurs. So a word that you will hear me use quite casually now in this podcast and in general is the word queer, which today has by the majority of the LGBT community has been reclaimed. There are still some people who think that it is a slur and that we should not use it to identify ourselves or others. But at this point, that ship has left the dock, you know? It's queer history, queer historiography is what it is academically called, as well as just casually. So the point is that the terms to speak about same-sex attraction or gender difference have completely changed and continue to change every, you know, I don't know, a couple decades. There's a whole new set of words to speak about all kinds of things, not just in the queer community, but also, I mean, we don't call it atomic science anymore. It's nuclear science. So in regards to the language that I'm going to be using during this podcast, I want to like address some things, because I mean, no person in history is a homosexual until after the term was invented in the 19th century and then popularized by people like Freud or Oscar Wilde, and the term had to be invented for someone, and then somebody had to know about it for someone to identify with it. And because of this, historians, we have no right to label people from the past in ways that they did not label themselves. So in addition to the fact that, you know, a term had to be invented and known by the person for them to label themselves as that, for a long time, activities were gay or homosexual, not a whole person. It was not, you know, these terms were for describing acts and not necessarily identities until about the end of World War II, mid-century. There's a point where a lot of civil rights movements in the 60s were starting to kind of like just barely start to develop in the 50s. And that's when these terms were more associated with people's identities and people saying, I am a lesbian, I am gay, I am this or that. So that being said, LGBT representation in history is super important for a bunch of different reasons. The easiest, the most obvious example to me, at least, is that there is still a debate about whether or not gay people is a new invention. And it's not. Queer people have existed always, as far as we can tell. You know, there are records of same-sex couples going back millennia. And this is still something that people don't understand. I've heard a bunch of times Gen Z is the gayest generation. And it's certainly true that they have the highest number of people who identify as members of the LGBT community. That's definitely true. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's that Gen Z has a higher percentage of people who experience some form of same-sex attraction. What it means is there is a higher percentage of the Gen Z population willing to say that they experience some form of same-sex attraction outside of the standard that has been established in our culture, and now they're feeling safe enough to say so. So it's a bit chicken or the egg, because you can't assign these labels to people in the past to prove that they have always existed, but they definitely have always existed, but yeah. So the point is, the LGBTQ community deserves a history that represents them, and people of the past deserve to be remembered how they would like to be remembered. Yeah. So that's my heads up. There's also going to be some pretty outdated and offensive language that I'm going to quote. So just a heads up if you're a little bit sensitive about that. And we will be talking about sex today. That's, I mean, not explicitly, of course. This is nuclear science. But in regards to the cultural taboos and practices around sex and around same-sex practices. I'm not calling anyone now a sex pervert. Using, yeah. That is a term that is used in one of the papers that I'm going to quote. Sure. I am not calling anyone that. So what does any of this have to do with nuclear history? And why am I talking about it if we don't have any records of anyone engaging in homosexual activity during the Manhattan Project? Which, as far as I know of, nobody has surfaced any records at all. And there's certainly people who did express this, especially in the 1920s and the very early 30s. Like, there was communities around the world. There was actually the in Germany, there was it was called the Institute for Sexology in I'm not sure what city it was in. I believe Berlin. But this man Hirschfeld ran this institute because there was a massive population of gay and gender variant individuals living in Germany, out and proud, and who had built communities. And you know, we don't hear about this because the Nazis came in 1933 and destroyed all of the records that Hirschfeld had kept. So there were individuals who didn't have the choice to not show who they really were. Trans people often do not have that choice. But if you are homosexual or bisexual at this point, if you are working on the Manhattan Project, that was very easy to not have on your shirt. There are certain cases where there's no avoiding it, and that made life for those people very, very hard. It also made life for those people not a part of the Manhattan Project. So that's why we're kind of trying to focus on this moment, is that, I mean, to put it shortly, it's incredibly relevant, even if we don't have specific names of specific employees of the project. It's statistically almost impossible that between 1943 and 1945, that no one in the nearly 500,000 people who worked on the Manhattan Project nobody ever felt any same-sex attraction ever, whether they acted on it or not. That's just statistically almost impossible. According to a UCLA report from 2011, which is now a decade ago, so I bet these statistics have changed for our world now as well. But in this survey, it estimated that 8.2% of Americans report that they have engaged in same-sex sexual behavior, and that 11% of Americans acknowledge at least some same-sex sexual attraction, and that individual states around the same time reported, in the U.S. obviously, reported between 2% and 5% of their populations as being self-identifying members of the LGBT community. So let's do the math. At the very peak of the Manhattan Project, 120,000 people were employed under the Manhattan Project. If you do the math, that means that 9,840 people may have engaged in same-sex sexual behavior. That means that 13,200 people statistically may have experienced some form of same-sex attraction. And even with just let's half, you know, the 2% of self-identifying people for 1940, that's still 2,400 people working on the Manhattan Project who may be among the population of Americans who self-identify now, had they been part of our communities now. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people. And this is just the statistics for the very peak of the Manhattan Project. This is not for the 500,000 that were employed over the whole span of the project. And every single one of these people contributed to the project and to this history that we are constantly learning more about and working to preserve. So we can't pretend that they simply didn't exist, even if we only have specific evidence of these individuals from after the Manhattan Project ended. And that's really what I'm trying to talk about today, is that even if there's no record, there are other records. There are similar records. And, you know, this isn't just an extrapolation of modern day statistics either, because that's you know, I'm gonna admit that's a little bit, you could poke some holes in that real easy if you wanted to, but there's also actual stories about women who served during World War II. There's lots of stories, you just have to go out and find them. So the most famous of these stories, and also my personal favorite, is about how two extremely competent WACs, that's a Women's Army Corps, two of these women stopped the expulsion of lesbians from a battalion of nearly 900 women who were stationed in Poland. President Truman had ordered General Eisenhower to find and expel all of the lesbians from this WAC battalion that Eisenhower commanded. Sergeant Johnny Phelps, who is a woman, she was born Nell Phelps, but everybody called her Johnny. She recounted in a book, she recounted in an oral history that, and I'm going to quote here, "General Eisenhower said, 'It's been reported to me that there are lesbians in the WAC battalion. I want you to find them and give me a list. We've got to get rid of them.' I said, 'Sir, if the general pleases, I'll be happy to check into this and make you a list, but you've got to know when you get, that list back, my name's going to be the first.'" Phelps continues, "I think he knew, but he didn't, but I..." Phelps continues, "I think he knew, but I don't think he wanted to know. His secretary at the time was standing right next to me. She just looked at him and she said, 'Sir, if the general pleases, Sergeant Phelps will have to be second on the list because mine will be first. You see, I'm going to type it.' Eisenhower sat back in his chair and looked at them. The secretary continued, 'Sir, if the general pleases, there are some things I'd like to point out to you. You have the highest ranking WAC battalion assembled anywhere in the world, most decorated. If you want to get rid of your file clerks, typists, section commanders, and your most key personnel, then I'll make that list. But when I make the list, I want you to remember that we haven't had any illegal pregnancies. We do not have any venereal disease. We have never had any negative reports. And we have always served and done our duty, just like we're supposed to do. As a matter of fact, since this unit has been here, it has received meritorious commendations on a regular 6-month basis. Now, if you want to get rid of these women, I'll get rid of them, but I'll go with them." Eisenhower looked at Phelps and said, forget that order, forget about it. And apparently that was the last that either Phelps or the secretary heard about the matter. So Phelps says that 95% of that battalion were lesbians, which personally, I'm sure that's hyperbole, but that doesn't mean that an investigation would not have led to 95% of the women, of the 900 women in this battalion, being dishonorably discharged. Because the way that these kind of investigations would work, it was a bit Salem witch trial-y, where if you could accuse another person, then maybe you'd be let off a little bit. And of course, all of this is leading up into the Red Scare. And the Red Scare actually had a lesser known companion scare, I guess, called the Lavender Scare, which came from the fact that it was widely believed by federal officials that it would be very easy for Russian intelligence to find out if someone with a security clearance had a, and I quote, sex perversion. And then they could use that information to blackmail the person with security clearance into spying for the USSR. And so this is why they targeted, this is why they claimed that they were targeting, quote unquote, sex perverts. So this campaign of trying to ferret out anyone who had same-sex attraction or engaged in same-sex acts led to thousands of government employees being fired, transferred, or forced to retire early, thousands of military personnel being dishonorably discharged or court-martialed. So in the early years, at the end of World War II, there was a report that came out titled Employment of Homosexuals and Other Sex Perverts in Government. And this was presented to Congress in December of 1950. And it shows that from 1947 to 1950, 4,380 people were booted from the military. They use the term separated by either court-martial or some other means. That means that there are 4,380 World War II veterans who were told that because of who they were attracted to, they had not served honorably. I think that's quite shameful. There were also 489 people who were outed and ousted from civilian government agencies. And then to make this, you know, what I'm trying to talk about, the evidence that I'm trying to show you that this affects the nuclear industry, this affects nuclear history, is that there were 8 employees who were removed, or some of them were reassigned from the Atomic Energy Commission. So, and this didn't stop. This didn't stop after, you know, this report was made. The Cold War was long, and this was something that people were persecuting employees of the government for several years. You know, you have a rivalry with a colleague. You could say a whole bunch of different things to try and get them transferred or fired. You know, you could say, oh, they're a communist, but you could also say, oh, well, they're gay. In 1951, there's another instance. AEC, that's Atomic Energy Commission, Chairman Gordon Dean reported to the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy that it was found out that the man who was in charge of hiring personnel at Oak Ridge National Lab, and I quote, was given to homosexual activity, And he was arrested in Washington, D.C. while he was on a trip, and that got him immediately fired. So I can read a little bit from the transcript. This is the part that really got me. So, Mr. Cole, what is the reason your folks weren't able to discover his weaknesses in the 3 years he was down there? Mr. Dean, he is perfectly normal, apparently, when he is down there. He is a married man. He engaged in sexual intercourse. When he goes out of town, apparently, this other thing comes on him. He got liquored up. It is when he drinks excessively. There is no indication from anybody down there he was even suspected of this sort of activity. So, this poor man was just trying to live his life. And listen, I do not support extramarital affairs. That is not what I am trying to promote here. What I think is sad is that he felt that he had to live a double life in a way that caused his wife and children, I assume, pain as well. This is not good for anyone. So we have dribs and drabs of evidence that it's just not enough for a narrative in the same way that the Johnny Phelps story is. You know, that's an incredibly compelling narrative that is very, there's a beginning, the middle, and end, but we don't even have names. I actually, while I was researching this episode, I submitted a Freedom of Information Act request yesterday to try and get, you know, the names of the eight people who were fired or transferred from the Atomic Energy Commission during this time, as well as this man from 1951, whoever the head of personnel was at Oak Ridge during that time. I'm going to see if they can find that out for me. So, you know, maybe someday we will have specific names. But even when we do, we're going to have to be careful because, like I said at the beginning, they may not have wanted to be called homosexual. They may not have wanted to be called gay. So they're very important. They should be lifted up and remembered. But we have to be careful not to say something that we don't know if it's true or not. And it was clear to General Eisenhower that this difference was not important enough to override the vast resources that this amazing battalion was being recognized for, right, over and over again.
Yeah.
They were there for a reason. They had jobs to do. They had to do those jobs. What are you going to do if they're not there anymore? Who are you going to get? But yeah, so this, the reason that this is brought up, the reason that I'm trying to do this research is because it still matters. There are many people in the nuclear industry who identify as members of the LGBT community. And their lives are still impacted by this culture that was established last century. There was a publication in January of this year, a survey of more than 25,000 people. So that's a pretty good sample size. They got 25,000 researchers who they asked in the survey, and they found that scientists who are members of the queer community are still today more likely to experience harassment and career obstacles than their non-LGBTQ colleagues. So, I mean, and that isn't to say that things aren't getting better. Obviously, now it would be highly illegal and also super scandalous for anyone to be fired from a position at a reputable institution of science for being queer or trans. And it would be even more controversial and even more illegal if it happened at the federal level or to a government employee. You know, Sandia Labs has marched, has had like a group of people who marched in the Pride Parade here in Albuquerque for many years. Although the last 3 years there was like a management change. So I think some people got, you know, whoever was the organizer is no longer there. And then obviously COVID. But, you know, if you Google LGBT nuclear science, it brings up nothing but positive results and reporting about honors and awards and celebrations of Pride Month from like really prestigious institutions like MIT or Cambridge. There are Wikipedia entries for women like Angela Clayton, who was a trans rights activist and an internationally renowned physicist. There's a man named Uzi Evin, who is a professor emeritus of physical chemistry and who was the first openly gay politician to become a member of Israel's parliament. In 2018, Danielle Tanner became the first Sandian named as LGBTQ Scientist of the Year. We're getting somewhere. We are getting somewhere. Let's keep going. Let's keep going. And one of the ways we can keep going is by looking at the past and trying to figure out what the mistakes were and not make those mistakes again. So on that note, in 2017, the State Department officially apologized for the Lavender Scare. John Kerry was the person who he was the Secretary of State at the time. And he says, quote, "In the past, as far back as the 1940s, but continuing for decades, the Department of State was among many public and private employers that discriminated against employees and job applicants on the basis of perceived sexual orientation, forcing some employees to resign or refusing to hire certain applicants in the first place. These actions were wrong then, just as they would be wrong today." And that about sums it up. We would like to thank our Atomic History patron members, of course. You guys, listen, you guys not only allow us to do this every month, you not only, you know, get to have this amazing injection of information into your brain once a month, but you are actively supporting the continued practice of history. You know, I would not be submitting Freedom of Information Acts without you guys. I would not be delving elbow deep into Wikipedia or archives if it weren't for the fact that you guys are sponsoring us, and we really appreciate it. You're making history, literally making history. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it. All of our other listeners, you guys are great too. We really appreciate you as well.
We appreciate you guys, and we thank you guys for hanging in with us on this one. Be kind. And yeah, so on this one here, I will add to my standard ending. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say, be kind and don't forget.
We love you. And
to wash your hands.
Don't forget to wash your hands.
Radioactive Waves has been presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Join us next time for more interviews, histories, and insights on topics like the Manhattan Project, science and pop culture, the atomic age, and the differences between nuclear fact and fiction.